CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Malcolm Hoenlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, and we're very pleased to welcome our colleague Ilan Berman, the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C., because we have mysteries that may disappear in time, but right now, because of the convergence of Ramadan, Passover, and Easter, there looks to be a wave of violence inside Israel by disparate players. Ilan, a very good evening to you. My information is incomplete, but ISIS is mentioned for some. Fatah, Al-Aqsa is mentioned for one or more, and then none of the above. This doesn't look like a pattern. Have I missed it? What is the driver for this, or are these copycats of loners? Good evening to you.
Hi, John. Hi, Malcolm. So I think that's a great question, and I think your gut instinct is correct. We're not looking at a grand strategy by any one actor, but there is a common thread. The common thread here is to destabilize the domestic situation in Israel enough so that it looks volatile. Obviously, Israel has racked up over the last year some pretty remarkable political and strategic successes as the Abraham Accords, for example, continue full throttle. And so there is, on the part of recidivist elements, there is a drive, a desire, a general thrust to diminish Israel. And one of the most surefire ways, short of a new war between Israel and Palestinian rejectionist groups, is to cause this sort of general disorder that makes Israel seem like a less attractive economic and political bet. And my sense is that's what you're seeing.
Malcolm?
Do you see that there is a broader base of support? We saw the incidents last night when troops went in to arrest and stop a terrorist cell that was about to carry out a large-scale Passover massacre-type event. Do you see that it's a nascent thing, or is it through outside influences who are trying to manipulate, because you don't see a general uprising in the Arab population?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Because, you know, historically, when we look at the elements that created the first Intifada, that created the second Intifada, you were really looking at two conditions. You were looking at economic depression in the Palestinian territories. You were looking at political dissatisfaction, and you were looking at some sort of spark that touched things off. If you look at the situation now, you have a economic underperformance, a real sustained failure to thrive on the part of the Palestinian Authority. To say nothing of the economic hardships that exist in Gaza, you have a level of political volatility. But what you do have is, up until now, you've had a level of passivity on the part of the Palestinian population writ large. But the kindling for another inflammatory event, a conflagration, exists. And Israeli officials, I think, are very cognizant of the potential game-changer effects that some outside influence from ISIS or from other groups or from Iran, for example, can have on bringing all these levels of dissatisfaction together into a combustible mix.
A year ago, there was a preparation for what eventually became the rockets out of Gaza, something to do with the Al-Aqsa basket. It was all very indistinct and conspiratorial. Is there any suggestion here that that's being built again, some case for an attack by Gaza?
Not what we're seeing currently, but the possibility certainly exists. If we look historically, there is a sense that religiously fraught moments like Ramadan and other holidays are often used as the pivot point to try to generate some political volatility. And, you know, that may well happen here. I hope it doesn't. But certainly these are sort of religiously significant times, and therefore the possibility, I think, is higher.
Does it suit Hamas or Fatah at this moment? Are they in need of anything in particular from a conflict?
Well, I think so. I think in a macro sense, what we're looking at is two very distinct trends in the region. There's this trend towards integration that we see on the part of Israel's relations with Arab states like the United Arab Emirates, like Bahrain, and quiet conversations with countries like Saudi Arabia. And there's a rejectionist trend driven by Iran, but also, you know, of which groups like Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad are a part. Those rejectionist groups, that second trend, is increasingly being eclipsed by the first. So there is an element of political relevance here. These are attacks that reflect a desire to recapture the political consciousness, recapture the political narrative, because, you know, the prevalent trend in the region is heading very much in the opposite direction.
Malcolm?
What do you think that the potential of Israel changing its nuclear policy as they look at the developments in Iran, some of which you just mentioned, is it possible that that Israel will change its deterrence policy, and what will be the consequences on the larger region?
Well, this is, I think, a fascinating conversation, and it's something I heard when I was there about a month ago, that because of the current negotiations between Iran and the Biden administration in Vienna to revive the JCPOA, because of the fact that there doesn't seem to be anything stopping Iran's march towards nuclear status, the Israelis are increasingly thinking about both a plan B and a plan C. The plan B, I think, is reasonably well known, and it involves building a independent military option to strike Iran's nuclear program. The Israelis talk about it modestly, not to eliminate Iran's nuclear program, but at least to set it back a number of years. But increasingly, there's that second conversation, the conversation about a plan C, which involves coming out of the nuclear closet, for lack of a better term, right? The Israelis have pursued, for decades, have pursued this policy of nuclear ambiguity, sometimes called nuclear opacity, where even though the international community understands Israel's nuclear capabilities reasonably well, the Israelis never talk about it. The Israelis never acknowledge that they're actually a nuclear possessor. But increasingly, the Israeli defense community, at least a segment of it, is talking about the fact that we need to revamp our deterrence posture. The only way we can do that, the only way we can create a balance of terror with Iran, is to come out of the nuclear closet. And this has all sorts of implications for Israel's position in the region and also Israel's involvement in international arrangements. But it really speaks to how significant and how grave the Israelis think the Iranian nuclear problem has gotten, that they're having these conversations.
The war in Ukraine, Ilan, we're told that Russia is either drafting or hiring Syrian soldiers. Is that accurate? And does that disorder Iran, Damascus, or Hezbollah in their activities to have people taken off as mercenaries?
Well, they are. The Russians are having a manpower problem. It's very clear. We're now in day 49 of the Ukraine war. The Russians had initially fielded a force of more than 150,000 troops, but Ukraine is a vast territory the size of Texas, and the Russian troops are really beginning to get whittled down in a very substantial way. The Russians have gone to erstwhile allies like Kazakhstan, like China, to look for reinforcements for these troops. They haven't gotten reinforcements yet. And so increasingly, you see the Russians beginning to repurpose both regular troops from Syria, and also to welcome with open arms conscripts, or not conscripts, but volunteers from allied nations. Syria is one of them. The Syrian government has talked about potentially deploying as many as 23,000 Syrian government troops in support of the Russian war in Ukraine. There's no indication that they've done anything resembling that number, but there are already early signs that there are Syrian soldiers, Syrian origin soldiers, that are training and getting ready to deploy in Russia. And I think that trend accelerates over time.
And would this be for hire or when you say volunteer, is Damascus being paid for this? We just have a few seconds, Ilan.
I think it's a good question. I think if it's being paid, it's being paid by the Syrian government as a show of goodwill to Russia, because Russia is the key strategic partner that preserved the rule of Bashar al-Assad more than half a decade ago.